Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on data networking where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. You don't need quality of service or an SDN WAN solution when listening to us because it's all pure information, the good stuff that goes straight from your ears right into your brain, and it's all good. Excited? Of course you are. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy on the greatest ever living data networking podcast, we don't apologize for talking technical, for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard, and we certainly don't mind pretending that we know what all the technical discussion is about. Today's show is sponsored by Sonus Networks, purveyors of fine WAN technology. In some cases, it might be SDN WAN, but it's actually quite a bit more. And today, they're sponsoring us to talk a little bit about their product and how it could fit into your thing. And you know that Packet Pushers is about finding new technologies and bringing them to you in one way or the other. Joining me today, of course, is Mr. Ethan Banks. But let's introduce the people from Sonus Networks today. Let's start with Kevin Riley. Hi, Kevin. Tell the audience a little about yourself.
Hey, Greg. My name is Kevin Riley. I'm the CTO of Sonus Networks. I've been at Sonus for about a decade now, having a ball over here, kind of transitioning and moving with this industry transformation from TDM to IP, from voice to video, from static networks to dynamic networks, from hardware to virtualization. It's a fun time in our space right now. It's keeping us really busy.
And you guys have been around for a long time and been through different transitions. This isn't your first rodeo in networking.
No, we're about 20 years old. We're a global company, both internally and have global customers. We started as Class 4 trunking way early in the day when we decided, hey, we can use IP to build the core network instead of analog. We were very fortunate. We made that call ahead of most companies, basically helped transition the VoIP core to IP. You know, now we've kind of moved into a pure IP world, playing at the SBC session control layer. Now
pretty cool, actually. The majority of companies that we actually have are all startups, you know, with new products that just, you know, and they've all got that, you know, whatever. But you guys have been doing this for, you know, as you say, 20 years plus.
Yeah, I think we're kind of on Sonus 3.0 right now. We've kind of gone from Class 4 to pure IP, SBCs and session control to now virtualization, cloud architectures, and now moving into, you know, the SDN space, which I think is a kind of a nice adjacent step for our company.
Yeah, the software part is really what's, you know, the changes of now that the hardware is simplified to some extent, the software is what really drives it. So let's also introduce Dan Malik. Dan, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm a software fellow here at Sonus, responsible for the network system architecture. I'm here as part of a recent acquisition, Trek Labs, who has a history in software-defined networking. I have to think about how long it's been I've been working on this. I'm clearly still excited about it. It's been like 5 or 6 years already. Much of this came out of the Stanford Clean Slate research projects that we were part of. So, yeah, I'm still interested, excited about it, and it's been a while, so it must be something good.
Okay. SD-WAN, or SDN as a whole thing, actually hasn't happened overnight. It's been a very gradual transition, as you say, 6 years or more to get to where we are today, and it's still early stages in a lot of ways. But first of all, let's start off by saying, what are the key challenges that customers are facing, and what is it about your portfolio that a customer would latch onto really quickly?
So what we see out there is IP networks are flattening. All the traffic sharing the same medium. It's all competing for the same resources. So the opportunity we see at Sonus is to come in and provide a solution that helps manage traffic on networks according to business rules and business policies, right? So that critical applications that have to work, non-critical applications that don't have to, you know, work absolutely, can back off to let the critical applications work.
So this is QoS in a way, but it's with software control, policy, that type of stuff?
In a way, it's QoS at a high level. It's traffic steering. It's understanding the network conditions. It's understanding the network capabilities in real time and routing and controlling and marking traffic appropriately so it gets end-to-end to meet the SLA that's needed.
Right. So now you build session border controllers, which is like IP gateways or IP video conferencing gateways or IP service gateways for that sort of voice video stuff. You're saying that you have these gateways so you know something about the applications of the network. If you could get control of the network, you could actually start to say, I know what this voice call's doing. I know what this video conferencing, and then program it into a gateway device in the WAN and then map it all together so everything works better than it does today.
Yeah, the easiest way I think of it is it's a three-layer cake. You have applications at the top that are using the network, have wants and needs of the network, but don't control the network. They spray and pray bits. I hope they get there. You have a network underneath that's relatively static. It's slowly evolving. That's moving those bits according to historically, static policy. Yeah. In the middle now, you can have this sort of clutch that's connecting the fast-moving application layer down to the slower-moving transport layer. And that's really where SDN and Sonus's version of SDN comes in, is to really bridge the gap between the application and the transport. The SBC is just another application. It's a real-time application, trying to make voice calls. It happens to be a very demanding application, and it benefits from that clutch in the middle that can connect it to the transport.
Okay, so got this capability. We're starting to manage the WAN. We'll dive into the technology in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about your customers. Who are the key customers that are going to be picking up on your product? So if somebody in the audience is listening, what are they thinking about?
We sell these solutions into service providers as core infrastructure at the access edge of the network, to enterprises for either connecting enterprises with each other or connecting enterprises back to a service provider, and also over the top players who are purely hosted cloud-based that are, you know, delivering over someone else's infrastructure. So we play along all three dimensions.
So that over-the-top service provider, so I've worked with companies who are buying unified communication solutions from other companies. They go and host that in the cloud and then offer IP telephony services to people, or IP PABX services, that type of stuff?
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about security there. You're saying that the security in your products, is that in the SBC, like the voice and video stuff, or is it in the SDN WAN stuff as well?
It's in both. You know, the SBC is a real-time firewall, but then when the SBC starts collaborating with the network layer and telling the network layer what paths it wants to program, it's effectively turning the network layer into a network firewall, because it's basically saying what real-time flows it wants to allow into the network. So if they're not explicitly programmed, they don't get in, right?
Right.
So you can imagine if I make a call from me to you and we go through our equipment, we open up pinholes for you and I to communicate down at the networking layer. So we're effectively whitelisting all of the real-time flows through the network, which is inherently secure.
Okay, so let's just quickly set a picture here. What I'm imagining is, and tell me if I'm wrong, right? So I've got this WAN, I've got 100 branch offices or 1,000 branch offices, and I've got IP calls and video conferencing going all over the place, and then I start to drop down your NAS, your Network as a Service appliances. Is that called NAS IQ?
Yep. NAS IQ, correct.
NAS IQ, which is NAS, Network as a Service, IQ as capital I, capital Q, which is the name of the boxes that you have, right?
Yep.
They go down at various key points in the WAN infrastructure, and then they get visibility into the flows of data that are passing through them. So because of that, they can start to count it and control it.
Yeah, I'll pop it up just one level, really. Mm-hmm. You don't deploy Sonus boxes. We just use standard white box switches, which Dan will get into later, that are open flow enabled. So we use third-party switching equipment, and the easiest way to think about them is they're like toll booths on a highway. You put them where you want to exercise points of control. And NAS IQ is a centralized controlling policy engine that's exercising control over those toll booths in the network. So you could imagine you'd put these switches at all the different interconnects of your enterprise, or they're already there, they exist already. NAS IQ becomes a controlling function that sits on top of those switches and programs policy, programs the paths in real time as sessions are coming up and down and services are being turned up and down.
By already there, you're talking about a switch that you have on your network that happens to be OpenFlow capable in a way that works with the Sonus software.
Exactly. We don't aspire to be in the switch selling business at all. The real value of our NAS IQ solution is the network control plane function, that application that sits on top of an open flow enabled network. Whether we source that network or those network components that already exist so they go buy it on their own, the customer can do it any way they wish.
One thing I wanted to clarify here, most of the SD-WAN solutions that we've talked about on the show are an overlay where the traffic that's being managed flows between two SD-WAN endpoints on the network. This is where the Sonus network solution starts to look quite a bit different, because that is not what this is. This is not an overlay. This is, as you described it, toll booths. Some point on the network where you say, okay, as traffic leaves this point, we're going to give the traffic these sorts of characteristics per directives that you populate with OpenFlow.
That's right. And yeah, so it's an enter-exit issue, but also, you know, the toll booths can be interconnected. There's various ways to get between the toll booths, right? It's not just one path or like a
GRE tunnel.
Well, I'm just saying the toll booths you can think of as being meshed, right? There's multiple ways to reach each toll booth.
Mm-hmm.
So you also not only decide what you want to admit and the quality of service, but you decide how you want to route it, right, between these points of control in your network. There's multiple paths. There's multiple policies you can put on this stuff. Like, hey, I want to take the path with the fewest amount of hops through the network because this is real time. I want this flow to be resilient. So if a switch goes down, I want you to automatically reroute it for me, right? This flow can never fail, and it can never fail at the expense of other things that can fail, right? So it's kind of like a toll booth, deciding what gets in and what gets out. But also once it's in, it's deciding where it's allowed to go, or how it gets from point A to point B.
So how much of a customer's network does Sonus know about? And again, just trying to make a comparison to SD-WAN architectures that some of our listeners have heard about. Typically with SD-WAN and the overlay, doesn't know anything about the underlay. It just measures network characteristics between endpoints and then makes a forwarding decision based on policy from there and presumes delivery. Now, you're saying you can make distinctions on things like how many hops away it is between toll booths. So do you actually know about the whole underlay, or?
It can be. We can answer this multiple ways because it really is a flexible architecture that almost can be deployed in somewhat of an overlay type of structure or as an underlay architecture. It can play on both levels, but I'll let Dan articulate it and maybe back it up with a couple good use cases of how we've done this.
I prefer to think of it as integrated with the current networking. Clearly, we aren't asking people to replace everything they have. We'll, you know, start working with an existing network. And we can do a variety of things. The more knowledge we have, of course, the more control we can exercise. At one end, we know very little about what might be interconnecting. Say, for example, we're on two ends of an MPLS-provided network, and we're providing some quality of service at those edges, but we really can't do anything about what's in the middle. However, if that what's in the middle is a dark fiber, then we clearly have control over that, and it works precisely as we want. Other things that we'll do is we have customers that have taken their MPLS network and, you know, applied MPLS TP. So now we have a bunch of static LSPs in an MPLS network. Mm-hmm. And if we have knowledge of those, then we can tag data appropriately on the edges and have it traverse the network based on the knowledge we have of those LSPs. Some of this information we can dynamically create and create a topology. Some of it we have to acquire through other external configuration methods.
So some of it can be automatically configured by detecting where the other units are. It's sort of, you know, if you're on a point-to-point connection, there's a fair chance you can send a packet and discover another device. But sometimes it has to be configured by the user. So just like any network, there has to be some design and architecture to make it work.
Yes, there's always some design and architecture that's required. And, you know, we try to apply as much automation as we can to solving that problem.
Mm. Now, you mentioned dark fiber along the way. And you said, and if we've got dark fiber to work with, we can make the traffic do whatever we want across that path. So does that mean you deal with optical networks as well, not just what many of our listeners would be thinking of, which is traditionally Ethernet and IP?
Yes, that's true. In fact, our history comes from an optical background. So this notion of separated control and data planes is very natural to us. So we essentially flatten the network, L0 through L4. You know, we look at it as a whole network space where we can control whatever parts of it are necessary to affect the outcome that the applications are requesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I can remember. So when Sonus acquired the NAS IQ product, I remember working with you, like talking to you about those products at that time. And optical networking, Ethan, is just a case of putting the right SFP into a switch, really. Doesn't have to be like super magic for all use cases. Hmm. If you want to switch wavelengths around, like paths, then you need something different. But a lot of the time, you just want optical point-to-point, then just use the right SFPs.
And also, that's a good point. You can insert a DWDM SFP into a packet switch, and we can tune that DWDM. So there's a variety of fiber optical interconnects that we use
which can be pretty useful for your service provider customers
or enterprise customers that want to connect remote data centers. We do a lot of that as well.
Yeah. 70 kilometers between two points.
Yeah.
With nothing in the middle. You don't actually have to have like a DWDM, or you can just hire dark fiber. And you can buy dark fiber in the open market. I've talked about this elsewhere, but there are companies in capital cities or large cities that you can just go to and buy dark fiber between two points and rent it on a year-by-year basis.
Right, and it can be fairly inexpensive.
Most importantly, yeah. The disadvantage is negotiating with a dark provider takes a little while, but that sort of approach is transforming. Instead of always saying, I just go to a telecoms provider and they'll sell me some bandwidth, and then buying dark fiber and then attaching equipment to it is a transition in the way enterprise networking normally looks at itself. And I just wanted to highlight that because I've started to come more to that way of thinking because of, you know, the data centers I'm working on these days, that actually is much more effective than buying carrier bandwidth and having to put up with carriers every day.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, so now we've got these devices through the network at key points, and you can create, you know, you can put them where you need them to be. And some of that, they'll be able to be configured. Some of it's going to be automatic. Some of it's going to require deliberate design and intentional practices on the user's part. So now that we've got devices all around the network, we've got network nodes at different parts of the network, and some of those are there, have been intentionally deployed at the key points. And I guess as a customer, I'd work with you to find the right points in my network according to some sort of design capabilities. But if I've got lots of these devices, how do I manage these together? How do you control all of those network devices to bring them together into, you know, into an SDNization, if you will?
All right, so I think the real essence of kind of what NAS IQ does for the application of the user is it manages the network as a resource in a very clean, abstract way so that the user doesn't really have to worry about all the messy details. The easiest analogy I could give you would be like a simple GPS in your car. You type in where you want to go, it knows where you are. You can tell if you want to go on the highway, curvy roads, back roads, avoid construction, give it some simple policy. And it crunches and figures out the best path for you, and you just you follow that path, right? We don't like to use the term SDN controller within Sonus because SDN is just an architecture, and SDN controller is just a lever to program the network. It's really kind of the abstraction, the modeling of the network as a resource, understanding what the network's doing at any point in time, and figuring out the best way through the network, the optimal way through the network. That's really the essence of NAS IQ, and it just provides a very simple, abstract view of the network as a resource where you just basically say, look, I want to come in at this point. I want to go out at this other point. Here's the policy I want. Go figure it out. Make it happen for me, right? And the real hard work is what sits on top of what would classically be an SDN controller. It's that intelligence, that policy, that path computation engine that sits on top of it. That's where all the heavy lifting's done. And that's really, you know, the essence of what Dan and the Trek team built.
So to follow up on what Kevin was saying, Dan, I mean, there's some specific things that I'm interested in. You guys are making a distinction that the Sonus platform isn't simply a controller. It's actually, more than that. So, okay. So when I think of a controller, I think of he's kind of the arbiter. He's the box in the middle. And he's got northbound APIs, and he's got southbound APIs, and he kind of does the translating between what's coming in northbound, whatever the applications want the network to do, and then southbound, what the network's actually going to do. So I'm going to make a guess here that what we're terming the Sonus controller is that, but is also all the fancy software you've got that is making that happen. Am I making a good guess here?
Yes, that's a very good guess. We prefer to call the product a network control platform, where we've integrated a number of features that our customers feel are important and would normally have to develop on their own in today's environment. So we have things like topology discovery, path computation, network resource management as functions that we perform. At the northbound side, we have a very high-level intent-based API where applications specify, I want this path, I have these attributes, whether they might be bandwidth, latency, importance, things like that.
So the intent, I'll just interrupt you there. The intent we're talking about, is that coming from, ultimately it's coming from a human who's written a policy stating, I want these characteristics in the path, and then the software uses the intent API to express those desires?
Not necessarily a human. Our interaction is with other applications. Might be a good time to discuss a couple of examples, if I may. You know, Kevin was talking about the SBC as an application and what it does. So to the NAS IQ control platform, the SBC is requesting this path connectivity between these endpoints. You know, it has bandwidth requirements. And so on. So that comes from that application. And then we take that at the compute platform, and based on the network resources available, how things are interconnected, we will then set up the flows in the network so that that path is realized. You could have a service provider that wants to provide a web UI to tenants that allow them to subscribe to connectivity services. And so they say, yes, I want this sort of a connectivity service between my data centers, between a data center and a user or a branch office. And from that, we will then take information and program the network accordingly. Other UCSDN applications will do the same thing. So it's very much automating what applications are requesting the network to provide.
I've just got this vision now of the network where I've got these boxes, the NAS IQ boxes, put into the network that are now sitting in the traffic flow, and you've got flow management coming along. So now we've got a controller or a software application which is now calculating the paths through the network. Now, the question that everybody always throws to me about these flow controller capabilities is how does it scale, right? You've either got to rely on the performance of the box or the performance of the control plane to do something. So tell me a little bit about how that scales and how that performs under load, and what happens when if the network flaps, if something goes wrong, something breaks, how does it handle that?
It actually scales very well. Your last question about network reliability is an important one I want to get to in a minute. So we've applied embedded systems knowledge to the product. You know, microkernel, task, parallelism, multi-threading, that scales well just by adding more cores and faster processors. However, the other thing you realize is that any changes in the network are actually quite localized, affecting only a few switches or a path here and there. So the software can very quickly converge on just those areas that need change, that need to be reprogrammed when something like that happens.
So the device itself is intelligent? Or are you focusing on, you know, calculating alternate paths in the system?
All the computation is done in the network control platform itself. The devices do not perform any of that on their own.
But they would be monitoring things like neighbor relationships and status like that?
We do all that in the network control platform. At most, the devices will be given a link failover capability, and if they choose to do it on their own, we get a status back from them at the network control platform. But other than that, they don't do anything on their own.
Okay. The challenge I've got here is if the path from the controller to the device goes down, what happens then?
Okay. So that comes to the second point of your question you asked earlier. The greater issue we see is reliability rather than scaling. So the control plane reliability does place a much higher load on the network computing platform because we have the inability to control a specific switch or get status from it. So that triggers a variety of recovery methods based upon, you know, how much hardware duplication there might be in the network and the resiliency. That itself does require more computes. So we may do things like have to inject packets in the data plane to see is a switch still operating that we're not communicating with. We have to then perhaps reprogram some of the switches around that if it's not functioning properly. So that is where a greater load occurs on the system.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what some of your other customers are doing, right? So I know that you've got some other customers out there who you refer to as using your products today. What is it that they're doing that's unique, or why is it that they chose to go with you instead of somebody else?
Two examples. I'll give an enterprise example and a service provider example. Within the enterprise, we have a customer of State Street Bank who basically is using the NAS IQ technology to drive deterministic behavior in their network. Okay, so they know exactly what's happening in the network because NAS IQ, our network control planes, programming all of the policy for the flows in their network. Mm-hmm. You could say, great, what does that really mean? You know, why are they interested in that? What that allows them to do is once you now have deterministic behavior, you know what's in your network, now you can run your network hotter. You don't have to be afraid that something's going to break and you need half of it sitting around idle just in case something goes wrong. They've been able to drive their network utilization from 30% to 80%. Without any infrastructure expansion whatsoever in their core network. Right? And it's because they now have this tight control, this tight policy driven by our network control platform so that they know exactly what's going to happen. If something goes wrong, they know exactly what the behavior will be because it's all dictated by their business policy. So they've been able to realize some significant savings by just basically monetizing what they have, running what they have hotter. Right? The service provider example is one Dan touched on earlier, which was PacNet. Who's now owned by Telstra. They have a bunch of dock fiber running around. And what they, in the past, you know, their model was, you know, customers would ask for connectivity, for bandwidth, you know, quality of service. They would go in, manually provision it. All of a sudden, you have your link, you know, a week or two later. And you can go use it for whatever you want. Kind of doing all this in software with our products has allowed us to do is to put the control in the hands of the tenant. So now they've moved to a model of self-service portals where the customer goes in, they provision the connectivity they want. They provision the bandwidth, the class of service. They're given the price on the spot. They hit click to buy, NAS IQ programs that in the network in real time, and it's up and running in minutes. So NAS IQ on that side, on the service provider side, in this particular example, A, has created an entirely new business model, which has now allowed them to put, you know, all of the heavy lifting in the hands of the tenant and save them significant operational costs. So we see this playing kind of along three main dimensions: CapEx, OpEx, and also opening entirely new business models. And I would say the fourth example that Dan touched on as it related to SBCs and unified communications is really just automating network control, right? Like, and it gets back to the thing I said right at the beginning, where you want to connect the app to the transport layer and do it without human intervention, right? NAS IQ can be that clutch in the middle where the app is driving the policy directly into NAS IQ. We're programming the network control in real time. We've done that with our SBCs, and now we've done it with Microsoft Link.
And if I may, there are a couple of other interesting business solutions that we've created in the past. One is, we had a customer, they were a service provider, they're providing a variety of business services. They had separate data centers where they were running different services in the different data centers. And this is something you don't usually think about, but they wanted their customers to have the same response latencies regardless of the data center where they connected. So if they connected to data center A, but the service was running in B, you know, there was a certain latency associated with that. If they connected to data center B, they wanted that same latency response to the customer that connected data center B. So that created some interesting, how do we move packets through the network in such a way to create the same latency response to a customer regardless of where they were connecting to the data centers and where the services were being located. So normally you think, you know, quality of service, make it as fast as you can and everything. But in this particular case, it was make it consistent across all of their services that people were accessing regardless of where they were in the network.
Okay. So, I mean, the State Street Bank one I've seen before. I mean, as I said, I was working with you in a previous thing, and they're saving a lot of money here, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's even a second dimension to the State Street dimension, which is not only are they using what they have much more effectively, but now with the types of control that we can exercise over basic, you know, just standard IP links, they're now starting to cap their investment in MPLS, right? And we're seeing this transition from MPLS to DIA.
Yeah.
Because we can do MPLS-like things on a DIA link that's much more cost-effective to turn up compared to, you know, MPLS.
Because you're not paying a service provider to make MPLS work.
Absolutely.
So now
you start to see DIA interconnects between enterprise sites where in the past they might have been MPLS.
Yeah, and you're paying the service provider markup for everything that they do on top.
Yeah.
And of course they're value adding and a whole bunch of stuff, but is there really value when you're just buying a bunch of bandwidth?
Right. And those routers that you're deploying on your premise, those MPLS ports are a lot more expensive than just the regular Ethernet termination port.
Yeah, you're talking hundreds of thousands per site for an MPLS enabled router these days.
Mm-hmm.
For a good-sized enterprise, small ones are less so, but, you know, it is a lot of money to pay up front, and it has to be amortized off, so it does cost a bit. And I think the second thing one was when you were talking about the PACnet one. They're a service provider, and they're using your intent APIs to rapidly provision bandwidth.
Yeah, so what they did was they built a self-service portal that they exposed to their users, and then that portal generates the intent-based API calls down into NAS IQ out the backside as the user's provisioning what they want of the network.
Are they running voice there as well, or is it just a data network?
I'm not sure what they're running over that network, because the product, as far as we're concerned, is we're providing network-to-network interconnects, data center interconnects, so customers very well could be running voice over that.
So, I mean, I'm looking at some of the show notes here that we prepared. You know, we prepare show notes, and you're saying here that PACnet was able to increase network utilization from 25% to 90%. So they must have been reserving bandwidth before for various activities, and now that they had this programmable control, they were able to drive the average utilization way up, as well as reducing, and I'm quoting here, reducing time to revenue from service from 18 to 20 days to minutes.
Right. And there's one aspect that we haven't talked about on the call that is noteworthy, and I think it's a unique SDN behavior that Sonus implements, which is when we program the paths in the network, we actually enforce the policy. So if I program a path of, say, 2 megabits between myself and you, Greg, we program the network to make sure that we cannot use more than 2 megabits. We meter those flows. So every flow we program is metered, and that allows the customers to really drive their networks in a deterministic way. So if you and I get really hungry or our application runs wild and starts to flood the network, it's contained within our 2 megabit budget. We can't spill over and impact other services or adjacent flows.
Yep.
And that's what allows the service provider or the enterprise, or gives them that confidence to say, okay, I'm going to run this thing hot, or I'm going to build it up, because everything is bounded and controlled by NAS IQ, enforced by the open flow.
Because in an IP MPLS network, you can't get that sort of control.
You can, but it's at a much coarser level. It's not as fine-grained. Mm. You can't really do a per session. And we all know MPLS isn't really geared towards real-time either, right? And that's, you know, it's MPLS is kind of a set-it-and-walk-away type of thing, right? And let it do,
fingers
do its
crossed
thing with static policy.
I call it fingers crossed, you know. You spend 6 months designing it, and then you implement it, and then it's fingers crossed to hope it works the way you think it does.
Right. So the metering piece is unique, and that really allows us to build a story for the customers where they can pretty much use their entire infrastructure.
And what about visibility and analytics?
We have a product called Farsight that really is kind of the network visualization and analytics tool that we've built that I'll turn over for Dan to elaborate on the details of what that product does.
One of the unique things about having this centralized, logically centralized control platform is that it provides a single point where we can collect all of the network statistical information. So we're collecting information from the switches. And then we have the Farsight product, which is based on Splunk. It's a Splunk application. So we utilize the big data capabilities, and this really does generate big data, where we extract all the network information into Splunk, and then we use Farsight for the analysis.
You're saying the customer has to have a copy of Splunk, or that when they buy Farsight, what happens to be on the back end is the Splunk engine?
There are a variety of ways that can be provided. Many of our customers are already using Splunk for a variety of things. Mm-hmm. So it's an application that we add into the environment that they currently have. There are other evaluation licensing or small product licensing that can be done with Splunk to provide the capability. And then Farsight is our application that then works with Splunk. So it depends a lot on the customer, what they have, what they want to achieve using it. The biggest difference among all of those is usually how much historical data you can store for the network. Some customers have years now of data store. So what Farsight does is it allows you to view the data as useful information in a very different way. You can look at the network from how is an application actually performing, how is an application using data, and then using the data plane in the network, and then how does that map to the switches that are being used in order to support that. You also get information about the errors in the network. You know, are we dropping packets? Are there other problems with the links? And you can also use it as a tool for network expansion visualization. Where are the hotspots in the network? Where are devices that aren't being heavily utilized? Can I move things around and take advantage of the investment I've already made in a different way to improve my network performance?
Again, you know, we talked a lot about in WAN solutions using software programmable control or SDN-WAN solutions. This analytics is actually key to extracting value. It's the visibility into the services that you must have to be able to provision the services. Instead of, you know, sitting there at the CLI going, I'm going to configure an access list that gives this 2 megabits per second, you actually get a much more workable interface for that.
You do. The thing that always surprises me is, you know, people want to look at the hardware topology, how our switch is connected and all that, and you quickly end up with a map that's a mess of what's connected and you really have no clue what's going on. So the analytics that you can provide by processing this data is huge and extremely valuable.
We've talked a lot about the SBC kind of interacting as an app down into kind of NAS IQ, but the analytics that are gathered by Farsight are extremely valuable to push back up into the SBC layer. Like when we talk about voice calls and SBCs, we talk a lot about things like least cost routing and picking the route where you can save a fraction of a penny, right, as you're steering traffic around the network. So SBCs kind of have this view of the cost of a route, some endpoint quality metrics, but nothing that's really network or hop-by-hop visibility. And the analytics,
you're actually saying you're getting your voice performance and the metrics from the actual network, so you can actually genuinely blame the network or not if the voice call's got some problem.
Exactly. Or you can intelligently decide how you want to route or steer or treat that call based on the current conditions of the network. Right? Mm. So it's a great collaboration where the network layer, where NAS IQ can feed back up to the session control layer and help it make better decisions through this analytics engine.
Normally, voice doesn't know if a path's congested. It just sends it and hopes, crosses
its fingers. It's like one of those applications crossed. I said at the top at the top of this call, which was, you know, they just spray and pray, and they just hope the network does the right thing. That feedback loop will kind of drive a greater amount of collaboration, more intelligent routing.
Okay, so we've pretty much covered the solution in some detail. What I'm trying to understand is how you sit in the market against, say, some of the other competitive solutions. We here at Packet Pushers, we've done a number of shows with different companies around this, you know, programmable WAN space. What is it that sets Sonos Networks apart from those people?
I think one of the biggest differences we have with our product is we're actually trying to use this technology in new and novel ways. So much of what's done is with this technology is how to do the same old thing in a new way. You know, how do you use it to how do I take a cheap white box switch and turn it into a BGP router? And that doesn't provide any new feature or function in the network. So we're very different in that regard. And it's not only about cheap white box switches. One of the other things is that in a network like this, there's a range of devices from inexpensive to very complicated packet processing that you can do to span a wide range of capabilities. So it isn't only about a router and a switch and how to do the same old thing. It's about how to do new things with new technology, with new devices, and truly create new features and capabilities in the network.
And I think what you're trying to point to there is the fact that you've been doing this for a long time. You've moved beyond the just get something working into the truly polishing the solution and smoothing out in the value-added capabilities of it. Is that a fair assumption?
Right. That's another important point is that, you know, this is very mission-critical software to customers. This isn't a research project that you can download and hope it does something. You know, we have institutions and companies that rely on this stuff to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so, you know, it's truly a product that meets those requirements.
So let's just recap a little bit on where we are, Kevin, and talk a little bit about the high layer. So let's just say if you're into this product and you want to know more about it, what is it the core value of what Sonos Networks brings to the customer?
A few primary dimensions. First, you know, connecting your application to your network in real time, being able to drive intelligent networking, being able to drive automated networking. That's where we're looking to drive value as we look forward. With this very powerful network control plane that we have now, it's how do we connect it to the application? How do we connect it to a user in a way that creates new business models, drives higher layers of automation to save operational expense, or drives higher amounts of network utilization to save capital expense? So for us, it's, you know, we have this core engine. Like Dan says, we're looking to use it in unique ways. And a lot of the ways we're looking to use it is connecting it to mission-critical applications so we can drive automated network behavior.
Kevin and Dan, I appreciate you guys coming on the show because this product is genuinely different. And I think this has been interesting to me. It's not just... So if we're talking about SDN or SD-WAN, I mean, you guys have brought out a lot of points here that distinguish Sonos from everybody else. So right at the end here, we were talking about, you guys were kind of poking at, this is not a product that, some academic thing that went on in college and, hey, let's turn it into open source and see if we can do something cool with it. This is actually a product that people count on and you can actually do something useful with it and count on it to be there doing something useful for you. Then the implementation details are different as well. I get a real kick out of the fact that you're doing a lot of this with OpenFlow and not, I mean, OpenFlow has been almost a
pariah.
Well, like people have given up on it, you know, like, I can't really do anything with it. It's too hard. It doesn't work all, you know, right with all the different silicon that's out there. And so, you know, screw it. And then Juniper and Cisco and those that have a vested interest in their own silicon, not really wanting to play. And so just kind of de-emphasizing it, customers aren't asking us for it kind of thing.
I don't like your bet. I'm going to go and play somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so now we got here's an illustration of clever and interesting things that are being done with OpenFlow, which I love. I love that because the more I keep looking at OpenFlow, I just see it as a long-term answer for maybe not everything, but a number of interesting problems in the networking space. And I'm also appreciative of the fact that you guys are It's not just about doing the same thing we've always done, just in a different way. Hey, what if we separate the control and data plane and do the same thing we've always done? Because why would we do that? Who cares? It's about the interesting and unique applications of this technology and what it brings, which is great. And you're finding those use cases and taking all the data you've gathered from the network and are doing something different with it when the case is warranted. You know, fabulous. I know we were talking offline here a bit, Dan, and you were mentioning that, for example, when you guys gather all of the data about the network topology, you could do network simulation kind of work with it, you know, which I don't even think we got to talk about very much, but that's great. You know, it's a really interesting use case of the network awareness that Sonus has just by virtue of what you're asking it to do for customers. So anyway, sorry, I just had a little rant there. It's just but as this show has developed, I'm like, oh, they're really taking that in a different direction, or oh, they're really making the most of this, et cetera. And yeah. It really turns into a compelling offering.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ethan. I think there's a couple of things here. When I first came into the Sonus show, you know, as we prepare for these shows, I was thinking this is another SDN-WAN solution and it would look something different. And then as you get deeper and deeper into this, you start to uncover the fact that it is, as you say, slightly different to everybody else's. It's using white box or white brand. You put the NAS IQ operating system on the box. It runs OpenFlow. There's a controller. And then above that, there's applications that drive it. So this idea of integrating session border controllers from Sonus and those other, you know, communications products is really quite specifically unique, and there's some vertical stuff there. As you say, I agree with you about the OpenFlow thing. You and I are both sort of converging on the fact that OpenFlow works when most people say it doesn't, mainly because they're all focused on quarter by quarter revenue. And Sonus has been around for 20 odd years at the, you know, in the carrier core, and now moving out to the IP-WAN. So it seems to make sense to me. So that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packer Pushers. And thanks to Sonus Networks for sponsoring the show today. We should be back again in about a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our guests from Sonus Networks for joining us. Kevin, can you tell the audience where they can learn a bit more about the product and find more information?
Straight off our homepage, www.sonus.net.
See, that's right, how long you've been around. You've got a five-letter domain name.
Yeah. I'm dating myself by putting that out there. But
that's about right. And can people test drive the product?
Yes. So we're more than willing to set up labs either on-prem or on off-prem. You can come to our executive briefing centers and take it for a test drive in our labs, or we'll go to you and stand it up in your lab.
Fantastic. Okay, so I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as etherealmind. You can follow Mr. Banks on his blog at ethanbanks.com or on the Twitter as Ethan C. Banks. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. If you'd like more information about Sonus Networks and links to where to go or some notes on the show, you can check out the Packet Pushers website at packetpushers.net and see the podcast notes that accompany the publishing of this audio file. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter as @PacketPushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.